Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our very special guest is Nick DeSabatel, a designer, writer, and thought leader, and we're going to talk about value-based design today. This episode is brought to you by Balsamiq, rapid wireframing software that combines the comfort and simplicity of paper sketching with the power of a digital tool, so your work is easier to share, revise, and get honest feedback on. Try their new web app, Balsamiq Cloud, free for 30 days at balsamiq.cloud. Hi, Nick.
We sure are. Hey, how's it going? Happy to be here.
We are thrilled. Thank you so much for your time. Can you please, to get started, answer our five questions of the Bliss questionnaire, and then we're going to continue to the main topic.
Sounds good. Hit me.
Question number one is, what do you do for a living?
Well, you already mentioned the designer and writer bit. I run a consultancy named Draft, and the main thing we do right now is what I call research-driven A/B testing and optimization for online stores, which is kind of a mouthful, but it basically means I listen to your customers, make small changes to your e-commerce site, and hopefully make you more money in the process.
Amazing. By the way, we had Nick a while ago on this podcast. I'm going to link to the episode in show notes, and we talked about A/B testing. Our topic today is a little bit more abstract, right?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's more generalizable to like any design practice. Yeah.
Tell us about your background. How did you get there?
How far back can I go? I started in computers when I was like 10. Been building websites for my whole life. Did math major. Didn't like it. Decided to continue doing computers. And slowly got into design over the span of probably around 15 years. My current job, Draft, I've been at for about 6 years now. And it's gone kind of slowly from I do wireframes for you to something more consultative, right? Something a little bit more connected to C-level and strategy with prices to match. And it's been really nice. I've kind of fell into writing in 2009, wrote a book about interaction design called Cadence and Slang that has, you know, done fairly well. And I've done four books since, including the one that's coming out at the end of this year, Value-Based Design.
Awesome. I own a paper copy of Cadence and Slang back from like 2013, I think.
That was the second edition when that came out. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have a long writing history, and now you're working on a new book, which is called Value-Based Design.
That's right.
Awesome. That's what we're going to talk about today. The next question is, what does your typical day look like?
I don't have one. My typical day, usually the morning is spent writing and the afternoon is spent doing client work. It's spent, and that's either sitting in meetings or doing podcasts or whatever happened, have you, that sort of stuff. In practice, that means I'm working for a variety of different clients on a variety of different projects. And I offer some kind of overhead for me to either like go out to lunch with friends or write another book or do a fun side project or something like that. So there's kind of the like notion of 20% time in my gig as well. But normally it involves me, I wake up, I write until noon, I eat lunch, I walk my dog, I work for clients, I walk my dog again, I cook dinner, I eat dinner, I do anything that doesn't involve being in front of a computer, and then I go to bed. That's a very typical day for me.
Awesome. Can you please elaborate a little bit on what exactly you do for your clients? Since there are a lot of qualified people listening to us, they will appreciate details like what exactly is included in your value-based consulting work?
Well, the most common thing that I do is I run A/B tests for online stores, and so that usually involves about 90% of my job is research. So it's looking at Google Analytics, trying to make sense of your data. It's taking a look at heat maps, scroll maps, click flows, that sort of stuff, funnel analysis, form analysis, trying to figure out where there are breakdowns in not only bugs, but mobile issues, usability issues, that sort of thing. It can also involve interviewing your customers, literally getting them on the phone after running a screener. It can involve running post-purchase surveys and analyzing the latest batch of those. It can involve usability tests, where I go to usertesting.com, buy a few credits, and have people complete transactions and see where all of the breakdowns happen. All of those things are kind of part of my practice, right? And so there's that looks the most like a typical UX design practice. Like, I have a very strong UX and interaction design background. I'm more effective at figuring out how something should work and how something should communicate rather than how something should look. So I do not have any illustration chops. I'm good at sketching, but only a little bit. You know, like, I can express ideas, but I'm not the world's best at, like, you don't want to put that on your production site, right? So I'm not what you typically think of when you think of a visual designer. And part of that is because of my background. I'm just very good at sweating functional detail, and that's a necessary component of design. Part of that is because the visual aspect is usually far away from the money, and I tend to be in front of the operations of a business. And I found that that works much better for having a stable and durable design practice.
Absolutely. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
The least is probably sales. Hate it. I have to do it. And as a result, I just kind of say no to clients really quickly. So I don't have to do sales very much. Thing I enjoy most about the work is having an impact, knowing that it has an impact, knowing that I can make a change and that it has a very clear direction in either direction for the business. That can feel very empowering and very gratifying, and it makes me feel like I actually have something that I've done at the end of the day. Yeah.
Amazing. What is your next big thing, which is your new book, maybe something else?
Oh, no, it's the book. I'm only spending 2018. I spent most of 2016 and 17 on the book and then didn't tell anyone. I didn't even tell my partner. And then I launched this at the beginning of the year, and it's effectively a book about how designers can prove the economic value of their work. We're historically bad at this, and I would like to end that debate permanently. And you can either go along with it or not, I guess, but the book basically conveys very briefly how businesses work and why businesses buy design, how designers can negotiate in a value-based way, so they're actually connected to the value outcomes of a business, and how a design practice fundamentally needs to change in order to embrace value-based methodology. And within that is basically some things that designers already do, some things designers might do by accident, or they might do when they call themselves a product person or whatever. And then some things that designers would never think to do because they would just farm it out to others. I make an argument that all three are necessary components of a value-based design practice. And I know I'm not alone on that. There are a lot of good examples of businesses and specific designers that preach materially the same stuff. But I kind of bring it into this practice called value-based design and say, you know, this is all necessary in the year of our Lord 2018 if you're going to be a designer and actually succeed. And if you are hiring designers, you should be looking for these components in their practice. And if they don't have them, nurture them and encourage them, because that's going to be necessary in order to have design continue to be relevant and durable into the decades ahead.
Absolutely. We've slowly drifted into the main topic. So value-based design is a great approach to doing things, but surprisingly, there is a whole planet of designers who bill by the hour, who do, you know, who sell their hands and work as pixel pushers, and they all deserve better thinking. So what do you think thought number one should occur to them so that they start thinking from the business standpoint? And what should occur to designers so that they start learning about the business ecosystem?
Yeah, so when a business hires you, it's so that you can return back a certain amount of economic activity to the business. Like, they're not hiring you because they want you to have fun, and they're not hiring you because they think that play is great. they're hiring you because they think that play could potentially result in an economic impact in the business. And that is either in the form of increased safety, because there's a lot of competitors that are, you know, besieging the business with good design, and customers are buying good design or whatever have you. It could be in reduced risk. You're a safe bet. You have a pedigree. You have a track record for doing a specific thing. This is something that is useful for, you know, longer term designers who've had a good track record and decent portfolio of consistent, you know, high performing work. Or it could be that you have a palpable business outcome, like in my practice, right? So let's say you're a UX designer and you design, say, a better help desk app for an internal company, something like that. Okay, well, it helps the salespeople be a little bit more efficient. Okay, well, what's the loaded cost of a salesperson? Okay, how much time are you saving them? Now you have basically a number on the actual work that you're generating. Businesses like to get between 6 and 10x return on investment on their headcount. Any less than that, and you're perceived as drag on resources, and it's probably cheaper to hire a new person. Any more than that, they'll take it. But, you know, most of the time, you kind of fall within that 6 to 10x range. There are two examples of this that I like to cite that are both logo design. One of them is the original Nike swoosh logo cost, I believe, $210 in 2017 dollars. This may back more than that for Nike, right? Like, it's
I've read
the
their
most
book.
Important.
It's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of the most important and iconic logos of Western civilization. That's not a joke. It's not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. The other is, and Blair Enns, in his book Price and Creativity that came out, cites both of these two. So I'm partly ripping him off, just credit where credit's due. The other one is Tropicana. They replaced a logo, gosh, like 7 or 8 years ago, something like that. And sales dropped by a third immediately.
Really?
Really? Oh, yeah. They lost tens of millions of dollars on this logo. They frantically replaced all of their packaging with the old logo in order to like salvage orange juice and not throw away like tons and tons of like literal tons of orange juice. So that is risk, right? Like, obviously that's a very clear expression of business risk. And the people that are hiring you and that are paying for you, they know about this stuff, right? They're making this sort of calculation in the back of their head. And if you want to meet them halfway and have a negotiation, you have to start thinking like them too. I think that design as a profession, not just in terms of agencies, but also especially agencies, but also in terms of in-house work, they're a few steps away from the machinations of the business. Like, they don't ever bother to ask, why am I doing this work? This happened to me all the time when I worked in agencies before I started Draft. They would just hand me work and I would do the work and it would be fun. And I think, and I'm post fun at this point. And I think that as agency pricing becomes a race to the bottom, and as you have more and more people, you know, scrimping $5 projects on Upwork or whatever have you, which is not good, you're going to see more and more people start to think about this in a business and strategic way, or they're going to fail. So I think if you want to continue doing design, you have to eat your vegetables and do the hard work of understanding why you're being hired.
We just had a couple hours ago, we had an extensive conversation with Jonathan Stark about quitting hourly billing and switching to value-based pricing. So he offered an amazing framework of three whys, which is asking, why are you bothering to do this at all? Why are you bothering to do this now? And why exactly you came to me, not to some lower priced alternative? And I just think it's purely gold.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Alan Weiss also, he says, why me, why now, why in this manner, right? And that shuffles the order around, but I think it's very similar, right? And people don't ever bother asking that. Like, why are you coming to me for this? What did you find in my cover letter? Like, whoever bothers to ask that in a W-2 gig? And there's no harm in doing it. I think that's a little bit of a disarming question, but it's not, I don't think it's going to deep six your chances. It's like, why me, right? Like, you know that when you apply for a job, there's like 500 other applications. How'd you get through? might have been sheer cronyism, but it might also have been that they found something in you that was interesting. And knowing that is very powerful, right? Regardless of whether you're independent.
Frankly speaking, I have to confess, I consider myself a rather advanced consultant, but I have not been playing this Y game with my client. And I would love to ask you, what response do you usually get asking that question to your client?
Like, why do they find me, or why do they...
Why exactly did they refer to you? Because you're super expensive as opposed to other consultants.
Yeah, they don't know my price until the end, which is great.
So you don't publish prices on your website?
No. Nope. Not anymore. Okay. So there's that.
You're another camp.
I'm also in another camp because about 80% of my inbound leads are referral-based because I've built up a pedigree over 6 years and a solid track record. Like, if you go to draft.nu/helped, that's all of our, you know, not all, but all of our most successful case studies with names you've heard of. And so there's that. I've built up a really solid reputation, but if people just come in the door not knowing me, yeah, I'll ask that question. And the most common thing is we know that we need to be A/B testing. So they're not thinking about Nick DeSabato. They're thinking about they need to be doing this thing, and I have A/B testing plastered all over my website, and therefore I'm a good fit for it. But okay, they could go to anyone, right? Like, after I launched Draft Revise 4.5 years ago, which is the big quarterly A/B testing service I run, I can't tell you how many ripoffs there are on the internet. There are so many ripoffs. You can Google or go into like a plagiarism search engine for, I'm deadly serious, for any iteration on archive.org of my marketing page, you will find hundreds of people that, like, they'll even call their service Draft Revise, and I'm too busy running the actual real Draft Revise to care. Why not go to one?
I know why. I know why. Because in 2013, Patrick McKenzie tore down your sales copy to an audience of thousands of people.
That's why. And it was great. But like, okay, so why are you coming to me? And they'll be like, well, we want to be doing A/B testing. And that's usually the answer. Okay, well, why do you want to be doing A/B testing through me? What did you see in it? And it's like, well, you're the expert. And I'm like, okay, great. That's a good thing to say. Well, I'm an expert in A/B testing. I've written a book about A/B testing. I've done a 5-hour course with Patrick McKenzie about A/B testing. You know, what? Here's my methodology around A/B testing. Copy paste draft method page to them where I just lay it out and I say, here's how we're going to be managing new ideas. And then I start to ask questions about that are meant to suss out whether they're looking for a consultant or a contractor, like how much control they're willing to put into the design process. One of them is like, are you looking for somebody to be doing like in-depth research for this? Who's going to be coming up with new test ideas? Is it, do you expect me to be doing that? Is it me or you? Or is it a team? Something like that. And there's no wrong answers to these questions, but they shape kind of how I'm going to respond, which if you say yes to that one, like I'm going to come up with all the A/B test ideas, I'm like, okay, great. Well, we're a research-driven consultancy. Consulting means that we're working with the C-level as an equal to develop strategies. So you're going to need a pretend like you're hiring a business partner. Haven't talked about price yet. It's research-driven because you can come up with all the ideas you want, but if we don't research that they're the right ideas, then we're not going to launch them. And I'm contractually binding you to not launch them. So I will walk if you launch them. And if you don't want that, there are millions of $50 JavaScript developers on Upwork who can put together tests on VWO for you. Go on there and find one. But you have, and I tell them point blank, that exact phrase. Like, if you don't want this, I'm not cheap, but I'm a reliable, safe bet, right? And I make back more than I cost. I have literally posted on my marketing page, I generate, on average, 6.2 times more than my fees, no matter what fees I charge. That is calculated from all of my A/B tests. It goes down sometimes.
You're almost reading my mind with the next question, which is, what if, as a designer, you work in an industry that is less quantifiable than A/B testing?
Yeah.
For example, I'm redesigning web applications. There is, like... It's going to be hard to measure, well, what impact it has on the business. But of course it will. It's just hard to put a number in it. What other methods you can use to prove value there and attach a number to that and charge accordingly?
So I mentioned earlier that there's risk, right? There's an issue there. So you can frame it like that. There are case studies that talk about ROI from a specific logo redesign or an illustration or something like that. I'm always shocked that people don't use them. Like Jared Spool has dozens. Happy Cog has a ton. Baymard Institute, Conversion XL both have tons. If you do copy editing, Joanna Wiebe is basically the grand vizier of this, and she has dozens on her website. Go to those resources and say, hey, these are good examples of people that use design to increase business results, right? And if you're green to the field, like, you can still use other people's work to say, I know what I'm talking about, and I'm going to be focusing on the same things that these experts are. Once you get more expert, you can talk about it in terms of your past pedigree of reducing risk. In the particular example of the web application, I actually think there are things that you can measure. You can measure churn. You can measure customer satisfaction, support inquiries, all of those things. You should be listening to those things. And as designers, we historically don't do that. That's the real problem, is that we leave the job of measurement to other people. So I think I would half unask the question and say the best thing to do is start paying attention to, like, key business metrics and to say, okay, well, the redesign is going to launch on, say, July 17th, right? Well, we're going to put a little annotation in the analytics software that says it launched on July 17th. And then we're going to look at all the numbers before. We're going to make segments that say this happened before. And we're going to make segments that say this happened after. And if there's a massive step function in churn, then we know something happened on July 17th. Hint, it was my redesign. Right? Like, and why don't designers do that?
I don't do that.
Why don't people do that? Like, you don't do that, but, like, no one does that. I do that, but no one does
right. That.
Like, why don't people do that?
Because I can tell you why I'm doing that. I'm not doing that because I think that my client's time and attention is more valuable than measuring that thing that is so hard to measure, essentially.
Like, it's their responsibility.
Maybe. Yeah, and I know I serve, you know, medium to small SaaS businesses, and they're not measuring a lot of things anyways. I would love to be the one who instills those practices to them, but I don't want to be battling against, you know, the current.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that's like, do you have GA set up? Okay, we're going to get GA set up, right? Like, and that's like one of the first things I say to them, and they were like, I thought you're doing research. I'm like, I am doing research. I'm doing quantitative statistical research by looking in your analytics that are busted and horrible, and you never bothered setting up goals or e-commerce tracking somehow. Here are the three things you need to do to fix that. And I think it doesn't come naturally to designers, right? Like, you want to be sitting in SketchUp and like having fun and not looking. I don't wish Google Analytics on my enemies, and yet I'm wishing Google Analytics on basically everyone listening to this podcast. So I apologize for their poor user experience design. It's weird, and they make changes and don't tell you. But they're the way that businesses understand these sorts of things. And I have never found a situation where I created better analytical reporting for a business and the business owners didn't use it constantly and thank me profusely for doing so. Like, it's a thing that I've seen $10 million businesses not do this. And just even the fact that we can report it means you're already kind of controlling the conversation, which is wonderful from a consulting standpoint. But yeah, that's the second thing I would recommend designers do, is understand analytics better. And that's the, like, eat your vegetables side of working in the tech industry, is that there's data, it can be reported, and you can either control your own fate using that data or not, because others are going to.
Absolutely. And I see this as a very long, hard, long-term game where first you have to muster up your courage to just bring this up to the table, then do a lot of effort to track that, and only then, after a couple of years, will you be able to see the returns.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait for all the people that are going to get this book and be like, analytics, why do you devote 100 pages to reporting and measurement? I'm like, and why did you call it essential? I don't want to do that. Joe over in sales does that. I'm like, cool. Maybe you should take Joe out for lunch.
So when you were talking about your book, you mentioned there are three pillar practices that every designer should embrace in order to say that they're doing value-based design. Can you please recap those and maybe elaborate a little bit?
The three pillars of value-based design are research, which we've already talked about a little bit, all the different techniques that I personally use. But effectively, it's listening to your customers and understanding how they behave. Second thing is measurement, which we just talked about. It is looking in analytics and trying to understand the economic impact of your design decisions. So that sort of step function thing that we were talking about earlier, where your redesign launches and you continue measuring it. And then the third thing, which we haven't really talked about, is experimentation. It's you have a design decision and you don't know whether or not it would fare well with the customers. So what do? You try it out. You, in this case, you know, in 2018, as of this talk, it's usually you run an A-B test for it. So you give it to random samplings of 50% of your customers. Basically, every other customer gets control or variant, and you are analyzing it like it's the scientific method. You are determining whether or not there is a statistically significant economic bump in metrics that you're measuring. So it could be ARPU or average revenue per user. It could be AOV or average order value. Those are different. Order value is divided by orders. Revenue per user is divided by everybody who comes to the site. So you can determine the effectiveness of various ad campaigns, podcast placements, et cetera, et cetera. You wait 2 weeks, 3 weeks, however long it takes to get a statistically significant sampling, and you call the test and determine which wins, and you stick with what works and throw away what doesn't. This is something that has become extremely ingrained in most design practices of larger companies for the past 8 years or so, something like that. It's gotten more and more available to smaller businesses. So that can change over time, the nature of that experimentation. I try to generalize it a little bit in the book and talk about scientific method type stuff, because you slept through science class for 12 years and then went to art school. So I try to make the science bits as palpable as humanly possible. Did I mention I come from a math background? yeah. It helps.
That helps, definitely.
But it's also like, this is very much where my head's been at for my whole life. And then I went into a creative field and I was like, why aren't more people doing this? Because the people that are doing this are adding a zero to their salary and being very quiet about it.
So let's imagine there is a designer who's been successfully pixel pushing and even making some sort of decent money, but they want to add more. They want to charge more. They want to do the value-based design business side of things. And of course, it's not an overnight transition. What do you think their path is towards practicing all these amazing things in their client
work? We're talking like a freelancer, an independent?
Yes, yeah, probably, okay. Probably so.
It's a little bit of a different answer if you're in-house or if you're like a W-2 at a agency or something like that. If you're independent...
We could touch on both.
We can touch on all of those things. Mm-hmm. If you're independent, my recommendation is start asking questions of clients in your intake process. Like the best thing that you can do is overhaul the process that happens once a client comes in the door and asks for creative work. Because that is eventually going to shape, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's a big ship to turn, but it will eventually shape the type of work that you're going to be doing into the future, right? So... the kinds of questions that I would ask, the why me, why now, why in this manner, as we mentioned before. If this were a home run, what would it be worth to the business? What kind of problems have you been struggling with this, right? You want to assess what the expensive problem is for the business. Have you tried this before? And if so, how was the outcome? Usually it's because, you know, they tried to redesign and failed. Okay, well, in what way did it fail? Is this an immediate need? Is this something that was being taken over by somebody else? Like my most recent A/B testing gig came about because they fired another CRO agency and they needed another agency to work with them reasonably quickly. And I asked them, like, how did it go wrong? You worked together for 2 years and ran like 75 tests together because I have your record on Optimizely. Why did you fire them? Like asking hard questions like that. The goal of all of this is to understand outcomes of the work, right? It's not what you're going to be doing because nobody cares that you're making wireframes. They care that the wireframes make the thing easier to understand and makes it easier for developers to build. You care about the kind of things that are going to be happening as a result of your work. And then you back whatever kind of work you're going to be doing out of that, right? With the corresponding deadlines, you know, scopes of work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when I write my proposals, I actually kind of write them from, I write the outcomes at the very end of the proposal right before pricing. And then I work backwards to create a proposal. So it ends up in, I cap my proposals at one typed page, period, and I do not cheat by going to single space 8-point font. I write one typed page, period. There's a cover letter that just has my logo. There's a typed page that says, here is the problem. Here's why you have come to us. Here's what we propose to do to solve it. Here's what that will result in for your business. Next page. Here are all of the deadlines that we are proposing for this if you execute the proposal on time. And pay me on time because I demand work payment up front because I'm in a design business and I have to do that. Otherwise, people will stiff me. And then here's how much it's going to cost. If you're cool with this, sign on the dotted line, we'll fire off an invoice. The invoice will have this particular due date. If you don't pay by the end by the due date on the invoice, we renegotiate the dates on the proposal, usually by sending a completely new proposal with different dates on it. Let's say about 80% of my deals close that way. They are very straightforward. Nobody cares what awards I won. Very few people care by this point what kind of pedigree I have because I've usually talked about it on the phone call. That's usually how people come in the door, but not why they continue. And I have found that by being extremely plain spoken and straightforward about the proposal process, I've competed against 300 page pitch decks where entire principal teams have flown out and won. And I go home I stay at home every day. I work from my house and I snuggle my dog. The goal is to maximize dog snuggles.
All right. And another thing that should that the person needs to understand, and you mentioned that briefly, that the role of our work as creatives or designers or researchers is not that giant, really. And what matters is the outcome of it, not what while everyone else focuses on their craft and loses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, everybody wants to continue honing their design craft by getting, like, the new stencils or, like, understanding Flexbox better. But you're already be doing that. I don't have to tell you that, right? Like, I don't think I have to tell you the cool new things in grid systems. Like, Josef Mueller-Brockmann kind of solved that for us 30 years ago. Like, we're good. We're good. But this is the stuff this is the hard stuff that's the shifting ground that determines career success. It's not whether or not you know Flexbox. You will frankly BS your way through Flexbox the moment you have to worry about it. You know it's the case.
Most
You'll
likely.
Freak out in private. Have a really nice, strong whiskey-based drink about it, and you'll bang it out, and it'll be fine because you're focused on an outcome. And this is the nice consequence about it. This is another thing I love about my job. I wear so many hats. Like, if this is not the kind of thing I would recommend to somebody who just wants to sit and sketch all day. I don't know how long that kind of gig will continue to exist in a humane way. But for me, like, I do so many different things every day, and it's amazing because I find new weird things to do every day. And that's why I don't have a typical day either, to go back to your earlier question.
It's interesting how in today's world we have all the technology at hand. We have amazing remote teams with amazing talent. We have all these collaboration tools. And once again, one-man shops, I don't know, can I call yourself a one-man shop? Yeah. I am, definitely. We're getting great contracts and great clients. We win for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, Draft's revenue began with the number 2 and was 6 digits long the past 2 years. And that's, like, actually shocking to me. Like, I have to step back and think, like, I worked a normal full-time job, and at 5 p.m. I started cooking. And I traveled. I took 7 weeks of vacation last year. We're recording this in the beginning of February. I've already been out 2 weeks of the year. I take enough vacation to make the French blush. Like, and I feel like I'm winning pretty hard. Because I like my job, I snuggle my dog, I go to Japan and live the kind of life that I want to be living. And, you know, I wouldn't trade any of that for the world. I, you know, it's not easy. There's a lot of stuff that's undesirable in it, but that's the case in any job, you know? I don't know.
Absolutely. We were mentioning people who are on the payroll and who want to prove their way up in their organization. Yeah. What advice do you have for them?
Get access to your Google Analytics install from sales. Number one thing, you have one set of political negotiations to navigate for the next 2 weeks, and that is, so GA has 3 layers of access. Your goal is to get at least the bottom crappiest layer of access in GA. And that is so that you can read stuff and create reports only for yourself. Then the next step from that is start diving into and being like, why are these numbers the way they are? And look for opportunities for improvement. The probably most typical example is if you're running an e-commerce store, something like that, you'll get mobile. Because there are usually like dismal numbers on mobile for everybody. This is a very strong case for adopting a mobile-first mindset. Now read Luke Rebuluski's book called Mobile First and figure out how to actually embrace that. Another front is GA will exist and it will be hoovering up all the data it possibly can, but you don't have any goals configured, so you don't know what the actual conversion rate is on any metric. So it's on you to create those goals. If you have the first layer of access in GA, I think it's called a view access or something like that, or like an agency access, I forget. You can create goals, but they're only viewable by yourself. The next layer up is you create goals and they're viewable by everybody on the team. So then you create them for yourself, start creating reports, start sharing them around, and start stating a case very meekly to get admin access to Google Analytics. The top layer you don't really need because it's the one that allows you to add and subtract users. That's like HR's role and you don't have to worry about it. But that second layer of access is amazing because it allows you to start creating things on GA that allow you to get the rest of the team involved. Because you're going to start making a case internally for paying attention to these numbers and starting to think about design decisions in terms of these numbers. And like your annotations when you like, you know, say the redesign happened on this date, those won't be publicly visible until you get that admin layer on GA. Yeah, that's what I would recommend.
My next question is, what is your favorite resource on getting yourself up to speed with Google Analytics? Because it is not an easy tool.
Oh, it's garbage. It's hot garbage. It's really bad. And I don't like it. But it costs $0 and competitors cost like 6 figures minimum.
Kissmetrics and such.
Kiss,
right?
Doesn't even do as much. I'm talking like weird enterprise-y tools that you've never heard of. Kiss is great. Mm-hmm. I'm not slagging on Kiss, but I wouldn't delete GA and install Kiss and think you've won. That's not useful. GA resources. The best person to talk to about Google Analytics is Annie Cushing. Her website is AnnieLytics.
Analytics.
Yeah, she is amazing.
Right.
And ConversionXL has a couple of resources for like brief preparation of Google Analytics. Like, here's what you need to be looking for in bug fixing stuff. But those are the two big resources, and they allow me to at least fake it. You're going to be spending a lot of time sitting in your browser while a progress bar loads because it's Google's fault. Looking at data views that don't mean anything, or fixing busted things like the Google Analytics tracking code is not installed on your cart page. That's incorrect and you need to fix it. So then maybe your next step as W2 is start talking to the developers and be like, who deleted the GA snippet from the thank you page, so we're not measuring conversion rate. And I'm the first one to figure this out. And that's when you go to the CTO and be like, we don't know how much money we're making. I've done that twice in the past 2 years. I've had to have that conversation. And just like, I look very grim and I'm holding my dog in my lap in order to sweeten the deal and make me more approachable as a human. Those are the only things I know as far as negotiation.
Side topic. I know you do a few interesting practices in your client work that I always often refer to your name about.
Okay.
One is demanding video calls with your clients always.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other is being quite religious about your client intake questionnaires.
Yeah.
Am I correct?
Those are reasonable. I'll do non-video calls if we've like worked together for a while. But the first call, oh my God, the getting to know you call has to be video, period. And I'm very, very strict about it. I will and do end calls because you are too busy to turn on video, quote unquote.
What about your client intake?
Oh, yeah. So I'll make people basically apply, right? So if you, dear listener, are a client that runs an e-commerce store making about, you know, mid seven figures in revenue, and you want to increase that revenue without increasing your ad spend, go to draft.nu/revise and fill out the application. If you're a curious consultant who wants to kick the tires, do not fill out the application. Just go and look at it, please. Don't waste anyone's time. That's it's bad. That happens often. Basically, you go there, you apply, and it asks a bunch of questions about how your business operates. And some of them are like a pull down that's like, what's your profit margin? And they're like ranges. Some of them are a yes no button that's like, can you afford this work? And gives you a giant number that, you know, is fairly representative of what my work is. And if you mark no, I never see your application. Then a couple free text fields that are like, tell me about the business. And that's how I get a sense of your personality and like how it is to work together, because I'm kind of getting in bed with you and I hope this is from somebody who has not online dated in 11 years, but I would not go on a date with somebody that was just like, you got pick, right? I would go on a date with somebody that's like, hi, I'm Nick D. How's it going? I'm a designer and writer from I live in Avondale. I like these things. Maybe we should hang out. Something that actually humanizes them. If you are too busy to fill out the application, I will usually ask more detailed questions. And then if you still don't answer detailed questions, then we don't get on a call. The next step is the video call. And then I ask you more detailed questions about the business. We go through the kind of Q&A process that we had discussed before. And then if it turns out to be a good fit, we move along with the proposal that I mentioned. And if you like that, then you pay me and then we start work. Pretty straightforward process. It's not really wavered at all in 5 years. You'd be shocked at how many people like net out at each one of those. Like,
I imagine actually.
A lot.
What upsets me is the people's inability to answer direct questions, fill in simple forms, and stuff like that. Really upsets me because these people run businesses.
Yeah, they run businesses, but they might be in a room, right? Like, and if all of your coworkers are in the room and I'm not, you're probably going to just quietly penalize me the entire duration of the engagement by my not being in the room. And so you don't understand how to work with remote workers if you're filling out three word responses on my application. And that's a really good thing to know before you pay me and I have to work with you.
Absolutely. Our time is running out. My last question is probably not very short, but I would love to hear what's your take on the deliverables, because I think that's another stage which is super important where you can show off the value of your work.
Yeah, man, we could do a whole separate podcast on that one. Deliverables are an amazing opportunity to get ahead of the critique process by fleshing out your thinking. I love writing very detailed annotations on my design work, and that helps me think through exactly what it is I'm doing. A lot of the time that results in me changing the design, adding new work. It's very good for making sure I know what I'm doing and that I've justified my decisions. And kind of in the back of my head, as I'm writing these things, I'm thinking about what kinds of questions people are likely to have when we're going through a critique call. And critique calls are very good for asking questions and not being like, I would do this instead. So I provide a lot of guidance ahead of the critique call to say, this is how we're going to have a very good critique call. And if you're going to provide written formal feedback afterward, like, that's more beneficial to us because it allows you to think through what it is. There's an old story where basically Jason Fried from Basecamp, he saw Richard Saul Wurman, who like is the godfather of information architecture and founded the TED conference and et cetera, et cetera. You saw him give a speech, and Jason goes up after and is like, I think you're wrong about this, this, and this, burf-a-durf-a-durf. And Richard Saul Wurman sighs and looks him in the eyes like, just give it 5 minutes. And Jason was like, oh, okay, I'll give it 5 minutes. And clients don't give it 5 minutes. They go feral when they look at pictures. So you have to like tamp down that impulse as much as humanly possible by augmenting it with reasonable communication and thinking through what the reaction is likely to be. And that's something that you understand with experience, but it's also something that you can kind of get ahead of no matter how much experience you have, because it forces you to clarify your thinking and be a better communicator. A lot of, you know, my job, even when I wasn't a consultant, my job was maybe about 10% actual design, and then the rest of it was a combination of communicating the design and being a good human around others.
That is so, so true. And remember that my favorite saying about communication, what the measurement of communication is how people perceived you, not what you intended to say.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's weird because like there's kind of a cognitive step and you have to think about how people are perceiving you, right?
Totally worth it. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. It was super valuable. We had a great conversation. Where can people find you and your awesome new book online?
Those are two different questions. You can go to draft.nu if you liked this podcast and you want to hear a little bit more about my work and my design practice. There's a link to value-based design on there. If you want to go directly to the meat of it, you can go to valuebaseddesign.org. We have pre-orders open until February 16th. If you miss the pre-order period, do not worry. We're going to be printing a crap load of these, and they're going to be available. You'll be able to throw your email address in a form there and learn about when those will be available. It's coming out at the end of 2018. It really is coming out at the end of 2018. This is not a Kickstarter that's like, by the way, we suck. The book is basically done. We just need money to print it. So that should be it.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Nick, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.